This RFM podcast was brought to you with the support of New Zealand On Air.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Deep Sky Adventures.
In the universe.
Deep Sky.
Deep Sky Adventures.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Welcome to Why Space.
Welcome. So, what's in space?
Well, there's a lot of stuff in space. 2 trillion galaxies.
All right. So, first of all, let's talk about what is space, because a lot of people get confused. Okay. So, where is space and who makes space, or who, what do we use to say this is space? This is where space starts.
Who made space? That's pretty.
Darth Vader?
Yeah. The Emperor. So, well, what is space? Well, space is everywhere. Everywhere around you is space. Our planet goes around the sun, or the star. Our star, the sun. That's in space. The sun's in space. Earth's in space. The moon's in space. We're surrounded by space. Space is just that generic term, really, for everything that all the matter and energy that we observe sits in.
But technically, space is a imaginary line called the Kármán line, after engineer Theodor von Kármán, who came up with the concept. And according to him, technically, space starts at about 83 kilometers above the ground. So that's where you're in space. And so he kind of like thought about stuff to when he came up with the concept. And so let's talk about why it is 83 kilometers. Well, which is kind of like now space is anything between 80 kilometers and 100 kilometers. So according to higher authorities.
Yeah, we'll see. So the question comes down to, here we are swimming around on the surface of the Earth in our bubble of air that we can breathe, so we don't have to wear a spacesuit. But if you go up, there's a point when you can't survive anymore. Like, you need to start wearing a spacesuit, well, at least to begin with, a supply of oxygen, because you run out the higher you go. But then you go even higher, you start having problems. There's not enough pressure, so your body doesn't stay in one piece, which is obviously not good for you. So you've got to wear a pressure suit to keep you all together and feed you oxygen so you can breathe and protect you from the extreme temperature variations. Certainly as you go through the stratosphere, it gets very cold. It can get down to minus 55, 56 degrees. And then when you get up into the mesosphere, thermosphere, all that stuff that's a lot higher, the temperature can go very, very high. And in fact, once you get into space, where there isn't any air and you're in direct sunlight, you're getting a lot of radiation from the sun, 120, 130 degrees. So, of course, you need to be protected from that. So when we talk about space, it's about how do you transition from the little safe place down here where we wander around, breathing quite happily, to where, well, there isn't any air. Now, it makes it sound like there's a line where you kind of go up, and like 83 kilometers, you suddenly go up, and then at 83 kilometers, all of a sudden, you're in space. It doesn't work like that. Nothing's ever quite so simple. If you jump into a swimming pool, there's a point where the air stops and the water starts.
Well, right? That's obvious, right?
Yeah. But space isn't quite...
The space, does air stop at 83 kilometers?
No, it's...
How high does air go?
So as you go up, the air pressure decreases. Because imagine go outside, right? You're outside, walking around, you pop out of the building you're in, and you look up. You've got about 100 kilometers of air pushing down on you. And in fact, it's pushing on you from every direction. We feel that as pressure. And Because that's quite a bit of air. There's a lot of air. 100 kilometers of air is a lot of air. So we feel that as pressure around us. And that's quite good because that pressure is pushing on us. You imagine, like, if your arm, it's pushing on every part of your arm, keeping your arm together. In fact, it's keeping your whole body together because we're basically a bag of a bag of stuff. So that pressure is quite good. As you go higher, though, of course, that pressure decreases. And it decreases, slowly at first. You go up a kilometer, you're not really going to notice it. If you go to the Central Plateau, which is at about 2,000 feet, so 700 meters or so, not quite a kilometer, but not far off. If you go for a run, you might not have the same peak performance you have down here at on you know where we are here, pretty close to the to sea level.
What about if you go on Mount
Well,
Everest?
you go to Mount Everest, things get a bit tricky, right? So.
You can still breathe there, right?
Well, some people can, yeah. So if you train a lot and you take a lot of different precautions and you limit your time at the peak, you can. There are people who've climbed Mount Everest, which is just it's about 10 kilometers up. They've climbed Mount Everest without oxygen. All right, they've just managed to get up there and stay alive. So they come back.
But it's hard.
It's very difficult, and that's really pushing the limits of what a human can do.
So we can't exist above.
Well, it depends on the person, but you could probably say anything above Mount Everest is definitely lethal for just about everyone. But re the reality is it's a lot lower than that. Long time ago, I went into a hyperbaric chamber where they suck the air out at different heights. We started at I think about 10,000, equivalent of about 3.5 kilometers up, so about 10,000 feet. Suck air out, so it simulated that altitude, and you're pretty lightheaded at that height, but you're okay. You can still function. You can still do
Can
stuff.
you still do jokes?
Oh, I hear you can still do jokes. You got to concentrate a bit, but that's actually about the limit where in an aeroplane, if your pressure that you're experiencing, so if you can't pump the cabin up with air like you can commercial aeroplanes, so it's an aeroplane that you have the window open, you've got to be on oxygen above 10,000 feet or about 3.5 kilometers. Then as you go higher, the next one we went to was 18,000 feet. So what's that? 6 kilometers. So pretty high up. At that height equivalent, you're not very effective. You start losing it. So we were doing tests like trying to count backwards from 100 and that sort of stuff. And then you could do it, but after about 3 or 4 minutes, a few people in the hyperbaric chamber were actually passing out. And then we went up to 25,000 feet. So what's that? 7, 8 kilometers ish, roughly 7.5 kilometers, and that's quite a different story. Like for me, I was passed out within about a minute, so I'd be no good at climbing Mount Everest. I'd struggle probably at base camp. But a few people who were in there, they were okay. They lasted 2 or 3 minutes before they passed out. But actually, everybody passed out. So, when we're not good at altitude, this is a problem, and it's because we need the oxygen, and we just can't breathe in enough of it because there isn't much of it when you start getting into really low density of air. Now, of course, that's really low. We're only talking a few kilometers, 8 kilometers up. It's not very high. Mount Everest is around 10, so maybe 10 you could push it to. You die pretty quick though without oxygen, so above that it's pretty bad. But if you go higher than that, if you get up to about twice the height of Mount Everest, so what are we talking there? 20 kilometers. Now remember, we're saying space starts at 83 to 100 kilometers, right? We're only 20 kilometers up so far, so we've gone up our big tower or a big mountain, or you've built a tower on the top of Mount Everest and you're climbing up there. There's a point where the air pressure gets so low that water, the boiling point of water has reduced so much down that it's getting a bit dangerous. Now, as you'd reduce air pressure, the boiling point of water decreases. And if you've done If you've got a pressure cooker, so a pressure cooker is the opposite thing. If you've got a pressure cooker at home, and you fill it up with your nice stew, and you cook it, the way a pressure cooker works is it increases the pressure of the air, so it suppresses the boiling point of water, so the actual stew and stuff can be at a much higher temperature. Normally, water boils at 100 degrees down here on near sea level, but as you go higher, the boiling point of water drops. It does the opposite to the pressure cooker, so you're like reducing the
I
air.
did read reports where people climbing on Everest, they were complaining that the tea tasted awful.
Yeah, well, so you can only boil water at about 70 degrees on the top of Mount Everest, or well, close to the top. Obviously, there's not a lot of room at the top of Mount Everest to go boiling tea, but you know, if you're a bit lower, you know that you can't get to 100 degrees with your water, so you can't have a properly boiling cup of water. I don't know much about tea though, so I like it with
No, me
coffee.
neither, but yeah, I just read that, so.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a point though where you get high enough that the boiling point of water is around just under 40 degrees. Now that creates a little bit of a problem because humans are mostly water, and you know, we've got lots of liquid. If you think about your eyeball, it has liquid in it. Lucky it's sealed though, so it's sort of it's probably not the best example because the pressure isn't so the pressure can't change in there unless you've got a problem if your eyelid's got a hole in it. But think about the contents of your stomach, right? You just had a nice big drink of water, and you've suddenly found yourself at twice the height of Mount Everest. Your stomach's going to start boiling. The content in it's going to start boiling. Your blood starts boiling. All that stuff starts boiling, and that's obviously not very good for you. And so that's why at those heights, you've basically got to wear a pressure suit, which is basically a bag, and it's pumped full of air to keep the what's around you at an air pressure similar to what you're used to, because anything less than that is not going to be good. So pilots who flew the spy planes from the Cold War, like the SR-71 Blackbird and the U-2, they wear basically spacesuits. They wear a pressure suit when they're flying at that height, and these things are flying up around 80,000 plus feet, so 28 kilometers up, so a long, long way up. And you know, so to stop them, dying or blood boiling, they've got to wear these pressure suits. So effectively, they're spacesuits. So the next step, of course, is well, you keep going up, keep going up, keep going up. Eventually, there's not really much air to detect. Aeroplane wings generally don't fly too well because aeroplanes need air passing over them at speed to actually fly. So you get so little air that aeroplane wings don't work, and that's getting up around what, probably 30. In fact, I think the highest aeroplane that ever flew, I was reading the other day, was a F-15 that blasted up to about 120,000 feet or something. But anyway, it's getting a bit ridiculous at that height.
There were some experimental airplanes as well.
The X-15 and stuff. I can't remember how high they went, but that was probably about 50K or something. So you're still only halfway to where we kind of recognize its spaces. And because wings don't work at that height because there's not enough air. Some airplanes fly ridiculously high, and like experimental airplanes, and the X-15 program was probably one of the most famous one. That was basically a rocket plane, little short stubby wings. So basically the problem is wings don't really work once you start running out of air. And it's probably you're probably looking at around 50 kilometers up. And but of course you still got a lot of k's to go from there to up in space, and basically what's happening is the air's just getting less and less and less and less and less, and at about 100K it's you barely don't measure it because it hasn't all gone, it hasn't disappeared, it's just steadily getting less. In fact, if you go up to 1,000 kilometers, there's only trace, and you have the right gear, you can still detect a little bit of air, not much. You're only talking a few molecules every now and then. You certainly couldn't breathe it. But it's enough. It is actually enough atmosphere, even at 500 kilometers up, that it influences satellites. So satellites, even though we just assume they're in space, and they are in space effectively, but there's still a little bit of the Earth's atmosphere that they get a bit of drag from, and that's of course what slows them down and brings them down.
And very interesting, when the International Space Station was first launched, they launched it at 350 kilometers. And the reason why they did that was to be accessible. So they were sending the space shuttle there to service it and bring parts and everything. And they had to boost its speed very, very often. So at 350 kilometers, it doesn't. You have to do a lot of work to keep it up in that orbit. The first Chinese space station, when it launched, it also stayed at 350 kilometers, and it had a 1 year lifespan, which is like really, really interesting. And if you do launch a satellite up in space at about 250 kilometers, which is a really high altitude, lasts about 1 to 2 months. So, having said that, there was a satellite called Goche that was flying at around that altitude, and it lasted about a year, I think, because it had a rocket engine onto it, so it was
Not
being
good people
boosted.
maybe
And
so.
like
So it
when,
runs out of fuel.
yeah, it runs out of here. So when you talk about the edge of space, really what defines the edge of space is this, how much air you have. And like if you think of all of the things that people use to go up there into space, you know, the vehicle that takes you up to space, you know, you can have balloons. Balloons wouldn't do much. So I think the
Well, balloons rely on air.
balloons rely on air, right? Like totally. And so the highest balloons are the weather balloons that can reach up to altitudes of 40 kilometers, which is a lot of kilometers for a balloon, and can stay there for months. NASA has these experimental, not experiment, but like balloons that carry experiments. So
Well, and
that.
they, in fact, there's a good New Zealand link there. They were launching them from Wanaka every now. I don't know if it's still going actually, but for a few years now, they've been launching these balloons from Wanaka with payloads on them too, because they go up so high, you can actually look at space with them.
Yeah. So, but they can't go higher than 40 kilometers because there's not enough air in there. So then you look at airplanes and then you look at rockets. Now, the difference between airplanes and rockets, I mean, there are very many differences, right? But one essential difference is in the way they operate. And the way they operate, one of them is uses oxygen from air to do the burn that sustains the engine. And the other one, the rockets, they have to carry that oxygen or whatever oxygen they are using to do the burn in the engine. So they have to carry it with them.
Yeah, well, this is a really important thing. So you think about your car, a petrol car or diesel car, anything that's not an electric car, you're using oxygen to burn that stuff. And that oxygen's coming obviously through the injectors or a carburetor, or depending on what kind of car you've got, and it's getting mixed. So you mix it with the fuel and then it burns efficiently. But that oxygen is the oxygen all around us. So you don't have to go to the petrol station and fill up with oxygen. You just use your car, just uses what you're driving past. Aeroplanes with piston engines, they do the same thing. Jet aeroplanes do the same thing. They're sucking in oxygen through the front of the jet, and then they're combusting the fuel in the combustion chambers to drive the turbine, to drive the jet. So jets, piston engines, they're all using the oxygen that's around in the atmosphere. But for a rocket, where you go up and there isn't any oxygen or tiny amounts of it, well, you've got to take the oxygen with you. And so that's actually, and you think you look at an electric vehicle. Electric vehicle doesn't burn anything, well, unless something goes wrong. But that's taking all of its propulsion stuff with it. Like it's got all of its all the chemical reaction that's causing the electricity out of the battery. That's all in there with it. It's not sucking in anything from the outer air. So if you sort of think about that, if you imagine you had to take your oxygen with your car when you were driving, that would be quite a logistics nightmare, wouldn't it? You'd have to have a tank, fill it with oxygen, which of course oxygen's not a good thing. It's, if you light a match, it burns very, very efficiently with everything around it. So playing with 100% oxygen is quite dangerous.
It is very
Yeah.
dangerous.
But for a rocket, that's what you got to do. You've got to have a big tank of oxygen and have a big tank of something that the oxygen's going to
Or
oxidize.
an oxidizer or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So coming back to what you were saying about flying and stuff. So flying, you have to have air to be able to fly, right?
You would guess
And
it helps, doesn't it?
obviously it does help, yeah. Whereas the rocket doesn't need that. The highest an airplane has ever been is this X-15 Wave Rider.
X51.
Sorry, X-51, this experimental aircraft, which flew up to 108 kilometers. So that was the maximum it reached, was in 1963, was way before I was born, long, long time ago. I think it's very impressive. But what happens if it doesn't, so if the air decreases, what do you have to do for the airplane to keep it up and flying? So
You have to go faster.
you have to go faster. And what happens if you go faster?
Well, it gets hot.
And what happens if it gets hot?
You melt.
You burn. So basically, what Karman came up with, this concept, it's this. Like if you fly too high, there will be a point where you will have to go super, super, super fast to compensate for the lack of air as an aircraft. And then if you do that, you burn. So that's the point that basically dictated the Kármán line, and that's how we know where the age of space is. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. Yeah, well, that's the edge of space. So after that, and then you're in space, but you still got a little bit of air, and it just slowly reduces and reduces and reduces.
So what's in space?
Not a lot. Well, actually, if you go out and got a chunk of space, you're going to find some molecules in there. And you're going to find some atoms in there. If you go and get like a pop up there, and you build a big net of say a cubic kilometer, you're going to find stuff. And of course, the closer you are to Earth, the more stuff you're going to find. Eventually, though, if you get far enough out, you're not going to find much stuff. You're just going to find a few molecules, and that's it. If you go out into intergalactic space, so out of the galaxy and go between galaxies, you're going to find even less stuff. In the galaxy, there's a lot of stuff, even between the planets and things. There's galactic, there's gas, there's dust. Not much of it. And, if you went and got a cubic kilometer of space, yeah, you're really talking a few molecules, a handful of molecules. That's it. So not like if you've got a cubic kilometer of, Earth's air. There's a lot of stuff in the cubic kilometer of Earth's air.
What about interstellar clouds? What about places where stars are being made, forged? What's that like?
Well, so the molecule count in those places, you've got about, I think it's about 1,000 per cubic meter. So 1,000 atoms per cubic meter. And if you think about it, on the end of your finger, there would be trillions of atoms. Well, more than that. So, 1,000 in a cubic meter—that's not much stuff. That's better than the most purest vacuum that we can create on Earth. We can't suck that many atoms out of a container to make it, more of a vacuum. So we consider space a vacuum, but it's not. It's only a vacuum because we can't make anything more vacuum.
It's so amazing to think about all these things that we talked, because first of all, it says how fragile we are, and we have this planet. This is all we have. There's no other place where we can actually go outside, open the door, and just sit down on a porch and have a coffee. There isn't.
That's right.
So that's on one hand, and how lucky we are to be here on Earth and learn about the universe. But then the other thing that makes me kind of like ponder is the fact that we are so smart and we can create all this technology to go up in the sky and experiment and measure all these things. So I think these two things are absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, it's pretty impressive. And of course, New Zealand's doing a lot of that stuff. You've got Rocket Lab launching rockets from Mahé Peninsula. So they're straight up into space and putting satellites up there that whiz around. And you've got Dawn Aerospace are working on a rocket plane to go into space and pop satellites in and then fly back down, pick up another satellite and fly back up and deliver another one. So do this sort of multiple missions in relatively short spaces of time. So, last year they tested their I think it was last year, their rocket plane. And then it went, that was the first time something built in New Zealand's ever gone faster than the speed of sound. And I think it went up to about 80,000 feet, so a long way up, 25, 28 kilometers, something like that. Yeah, this is really high up. So pretty amazing. So
Pretty amazing.
it could well be that New Zealand's going to have a rocket plane that takes off from the ground and flies up into space and then comes back down, which is
Yay.
pretty
That was
amazing.
pretty amazing. Yeah. So until next time, clear skies and look up and remember how lucky we are living here on planet Earth and doing all these amazing things.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. And some great stuff to look up in the sky. So if you can, go outside and have a look.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star
Safari.
Deep Sky Adventures.
In the universe.
Deep Sky.
Deep Sky Adventures.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.
Star Safari.